night I went to sleep in Detroit City, and I dreamed about those cotton fields and home. I dreamed about my mother, dear old papa, sister and brother. I dreamed about that girl who's been waiting for so long. I wanna go home. I'm big in Detroit City, from the letters that I write they think I'm fine, but by day I make the cards, by night I make the bars. If only they could read between the lines. I rode a freight train north to Detroit City, and after all these years I find I've just been wasting my time. So I just think I'll take my foolish pride and put it on a southbound freight and ride, go on back to the loved ones, the ones that I left waiting so far behind. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Oh, I wanna go home.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. And I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Going places that I've never been. Seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again.
Hello, walls.
Hello.
How'd things go for you today? Don't you miss her?
And she upped and walked away. And I'll bet you dread to spend another lonely night with me. But lonely walls, I'll keep you company. Hello, Wendell. Well, I see that you're still here. Aren't you lonely? Since our darling disappeared. Well, look here, is that a teardrop in the corner of your...
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have another in our series of shows about fascism by talking to Diane Feeley, a labor historian and activist, about the consequences of unions in the U.S. continuing to place their workers' fate in the two major political parties.
She argues that doing so has not served their members well, has led to a growing fascistic divide in America, and that what is needed is a true workers' party.
Next, we talk with attorney Marie LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights about her organization's lawsuit against President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Secretary of Defense Austin, alleging that the U.S. government is complicit in Israel's genocide in Gaza.
The lawsuit is now being considered at the highest level at the Federal Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit out of California, and it may eventually reach the U.S. Supreme Court.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The forces of the gathering authoritarian storm in our country are evident in many ways. It is manifesting itself in powerful and continuing nationalism, in disdain for human rights, in the entwinement of government and religion, in a controlled mass media, in the protection of corporate power and the suppression of labor power, and in the encouragement of violence. The power of labor has been channeled into the Democratic and Republican parties, the twin parties of capitalism. We need a workers' party, but we don't even have the nucleus of one. Race and gender are formative in the building of authoritarian regimes. We see this in the USA. Haitians who are black have been accused of eating cats and dogs. Women's rights to control their own bodies is under attack from the Supreme Court on down, and women are marked as childless cat ladies and told to stay home and bear children. We speak today with Diane Feeley on race and gender as formative in building authoritarian regimes and the potential power of our labor movement long buried in the clutches of the Democratic and Republican parties. Diane Feeley is an editor of the magazine Against the Current. She's a leader of Solidarity, a socialist feminist organization. Diane lives in Detroit, where she's been an activist for many years in the United Automobile Workers Union. Diane Feeley, a hearty welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
Diane, Chris Hedges, our previous guest, who inaugurated our series on fascism, what it is and how to fight it, is of the opinion that labor has to be central to protecting ourselves and to fight back. Why is this so?
Well, I agree with Chris on this. First of all, the membership of a union is diverse. And since we live in a highly segregated society in terms of where we live, the kinds of schools we go to, it's really the most diverse place we will be in. And we're there for quite a while every week. Not only is it a diverse place where people of all opinions, of various races and ethnicities and genders all work. And what is our job? What is the idea of a union? A union is not an insurance company. It's a membership organization. And therefore, it's about what we want in terms of our wages, our working conditions, our benefits. So we're concerned about the quality of our life, the security of our life, not only at our workplace, but also in our communities. So it's a very social place to be. And it's also a very democratic or potentially democratic place where we have to listen to each other, where we get to debate and discuss and decide what our priorities are. So all of this really teaches us solidarity, not only with who are our coworkers, but other people, because we can't just be concerned about our own selves. We live in this larger world. So that sense of solidarity, that sense that we are all human, operates against the idea of fascism, where only some are humans and others are subhumans. So it's really a very important institution in our society to really develop ourselves as human beings. So the potential of democracy through the unions, of course, can have a big impact, not only on our jobs and our communities, but in a broader sense in our world and how we organize ourselves.
Diane, historically, the trade union movement in the United States has taken the pragmatic position of rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies. Sometimes they've supported the Democrats, therefore, and sometimes the Republicans. But what has been the result, do you think, of this pragmatism? I mean, after all, the wages of workers in America have not gone up in real terms for, 50 years? And now we see a growing fascist movement, which is enjoying historic support among many sections of the working class. So how do you assess the consequences of this traditional union pragmatism?
I think it shows how so much of what we've learned in school and in our society and even in some unions is actually wrong and not helpful to us. We are taught that, I remember in grammar school learning that if you didn't like the situation in your country, you voted out the party that was in power for the other party. That is, it was a two-party system. And also a great focus on the individual candidate rather than on the structure. What's the structure of our society and how can we make that structure better meet our needs? So in terms of the unions, I think a lot of the concessions were sold on the basis that they were absolutely necessary for our jobs. I mean, I retired as an auto worker, and I had the opportunity of debating this issue. Would it save our jobs if we accepted two-tier wages? And my argument and my organizing was, no, it did not, that in fact it would just bring more concessions. But this is what we're told, that the concessions are necessary because the auto industry is going through restructuring, outsourcing, or automation, and that we just had to bite the bullet until times became better. But of course, they never became better because we accepted the concessions. And so we have to break out of this mold and seek a different way. And I think that's something that the UAW is trying to do now, through our stand-up strike strategy that we used. So we have to develop a different perspective about how we fight for ourselves. And that includes, in my opinion, breaking with the two-party system, because it does not represent our needs, as you can see in the platform of both of the parties.
Diane Feeley, what's going on in the Teamsters Union? It's one of the most powerful unions in the country. The president of the Teamsters Union, Sean O'Brien, addressed the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. He spoke admiringly of Trump, calling him a tough son of a bitch. He got wild applause. The union then took a neutral position in the upcoming election, but a majority of the members of his union say they support Trump, and Trump wants to get rid of unions. How do you explain all of this?
Well, first of all, I don't think a majority of the membership of the union does support Trump, although I think probably a good portion, maybe a third or even a little bit more. supports Trump because they see him as an alternative to the neoliberal policies that have existed, that both Democrats and Republicans have carried out. It's really sad when some people who see this racist, hierarchical guy as some kind of an alternative. But I think that's really what they see. Many of them say, well, I may not agree with him on reproductive rights. I may not agree with him about this, that, or the other thing. But when he was in power, the economy was in better shape. As if the economy has very much to do with who's president of the United States in a capitalist society. So I think it just shows how badly educated we are. And I must say, there are sections of the Teamsters who have broken with the idea that Trump represents an alternative. I think the Black Caucus has a different position. I think there are other regional and local Teamsters who have different positions. Unfortunately, there really isn't the kind of alternative there should be, where there's another alternative to neoliberalism or the kind of neo-fascism that Trump represents on the ballot in all 50 states. Because, of course, the two-party system likes to perpetuate itself. And so that's the horrible situation that we're in.
You know, there's been a stirring of sorts, certainly in the labor movement. Currently, unionized workers in this country, including public sector workers, only about 11%, whereas once upon a time it was at least a third. But there's been a stirring in the movement. Amazon workers have voted to support a union. Railroad workers wanted to strike, but, well, they were prevented from doing so by the Democratic Party Biden administration. The teachers' unions in the last year, especially in West Virginia, Chicago, they've been militant. You believe that what we need is a workers' party. Currently, we barely have the nucleus of one. So, Diane, how do we get from where we are to where we have indeed a workers' party? And what might be the role of unions like those I just mentioned?
This is the big dilemma, because there are so many problems that prevent parties from emerging, whether we begin with the tremendous money that's involved and the kind of legislation that allows enormous amounts of money to prevent anything else. I see that the Green Party, even when it's been able to get all the petitions to get on the ballot, is being challenged by the Democratic Party, which just shows how undemocratic the Democratic Party is. So there are certainly all of these barriers that exist. Yet at the same time, it seems to me there's more of a sense that the two-party system is not in our interests. And therefore, kind of looking around, well, what can we do? How can we move ahead? And yet we see that the top leaders in the major unions are very wedded to the Democratic Party. So I actually think that we were set back 30 years ago when under Tony Mazzocchi, there were attempts to start a labor party, and actually 11 unions signed on, but they were afraid to move to that next step of actually beginning to run candidates. So that was a setback for us. Well, how can we move forward now where there's a greater sense that we need a party that represents us? It seems to me we've got to begin small at the local level. I know in Detroit, many of the local offices are nonpartisan offices. So I think it would be a good idea if we began to run for those nonpartisan offices, get the experience, and begin to network so that we could do this. Now, actually, the Green Party, for example, I think has something like 150 people in office, all at very local levels. So it's possible that we could begin to do this and build a much stronger network, particularly based on a union here or a union there that would be willing to begin that process. So it's a difficult struggle, and I don't have a solution at the state or national level, but I think with developing that experience at the local level, that may give us the self-confidence to move ahead.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my longtime friend and colleague, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Diane Feeley. Diane, some years ago, the great economist and socialist leader Ernest Mandel observed that, and this is what he said, "We're at the foot of the Himalayas without adequate tools, but we have to climb up." Would that be your assessment now?
I think so. I met Ernest Mandel a few times, and he would always ask me about the U.S. labor movement. And I would always say to him, well, we're down, but we're continuing to go down. So maybe at some point we'll be able to start moving up. So, yes, I think that we have a long way to go, but we have such a great need to begin moving that I think we just have to start.
Diane, please talk about how Trump is using both race and gender in building his support, and how historically fascism used race and gender as well.
Yes, this is a very interesting question to see how race and gender are the building blocks for fascism. And it's amazing to see Trump and Vance present a kind of masculist line. I tried to avoid the debates, but at one point I turned on actually the Canadian news hoping that they wouldn't be showing the debate. And what they had was a man on there tearing his shirt off. And it turned out this was a wrestler who was speaking at the Republican Party convention. I thought this was the perfect example of a masculinist symbol. And I think everything that they say and do reinforces that they are strong and therefore they can lead. So we have Vance who talks about the cat ladies. We have Trump and Vance talking about how Haitians eat cats and dogs. So what is this all about? It's all about dehumanizing people, their attack on trans people. All of this is to say there's two categories of people, the humans, which are us, and the subhumans. And who are the subhumans? Well, they're all the immigrants who, of course, are illegal under their definition. They're the women who really belong at home and in the house. They're the trans people, and they don't have equal rights. In fact, Vance even says it's only parents who should have extra votes, and presumably it's people who choose or are unable to have children who should have lesser rights. So this whole way of their conducting their campaign, I think, indicates the racial and gendered categories that they use. And this is something that is common, I think, to every fascist regime. If we look at the Italian government, and I think under Mussolini, it's different than under Hitler, but it's similar in terms of choosing which categories to see as human and which not to see as human. And interestingly enough, in all of these cases, the home is seen as this romantic place in which the woman is the, I guess, the queen of the home. She doesn't have any rights, but she's there as a sort of sacrificial figure. So all of this, I would say, in terms of Italy, it was the nation, the strength of the nation. In Germany, it was different. It was the strength of the master race, because even Germans who were disabled, had mental problems, were Jewish, were black, were not considered humans. So it's only the master race that can construct the nation. So all of this is pretty sick stuff. But I think it's really about the insecurity that people have in a society that is very insecure. And certainly we're facing an economic crisis now. And that was similar to the economic crisis that was happening after World War I. And certainly that had a big impact on both Germany and Italy, as well as other countries as well. And we're seeing that same kind of authoritarianism arise now as there is this economic crisis as we go into a late stage of capitalism. In fact, I call it geriatric capitalism because it's certainly at the end of its life, and yet there is no new birth that's coming into being, and that's what's creating this frustration.
Diane Feely, let's talk about Project 2025. How do you see this as helping the forces of fascism in the USA?
Well, to me, it's like it's their wish list. They have a wish list. They put forward all the things that they would like to do, not that they would be capable of doing them. And of course, I ask, well, where is our wish list? Because our wish list would be quite different from theirs. So if we look at some of the elements, we say, okay, they want to, quote, restore the family. That doesn't mean providing parental care, reducing work hours, developing a free public education that's of quality. No, it's stopping sexual orientation. It's saying that all federal laws and regulations should be stripped of any discussion of sexual orientation, gender equality, reproductive rights, saying, okay, for the Department of Health and Human Services, there should be a definition of marriage and the family, which should be biblically based. Biblically based. Well, that's quite a narrow view. That federal agencies should be stripped of their regulatory capacity, and that all of this should be basically placed under the office of the presidency. So without all of the regulatory agencies and the regulatory power, what do we have left? We've lost, I don't know, 75 years of regulations that are very important, whether we're talking about health and safety laws, whether we're talking about minimum wages. It's all gone. Whether we talk about the environment, it's very interesting that Trump and Vance speak a lot about the fears. They appeal to the fears of insecurity that people have. But that's usually related to the border or crime, even though crime is going down. But it's never related to the climate, which is our most severe problem. How can we live in the world without destroying our environment? Those are the things that we need regulations for, and yet that's something that's not at all considered. Now, if we take a look at what their plan, what Project 2025 plan is for the unions, they'd like to strip the unions of basically any power that we have, so that the National Labor Relations Board, which is one of the few agencies that's set up to be of help to unions, that can help organize elections to find out whether the workers at a place want a union, that would be minimized. I think Trump has said on the first day he was in office, he would fire the main person in charge, the general counsel of the NLRB, because she's too progressive. It would eliminate many of the rules that currently exist. And what it would do, and I think this is really important, is it would allow the employer to set up basically its own phony unions. And so this really takes us back really 100 years. in terms of the kinds of labor legislation that we've had. Now, I think most people haven't taken a look at Project 2025. After all, it's a huge project. And as I say, it's a wish list. So even if Trump and Vance were elected, it doesn't mean it would come into being. It would be certainly, it would seem to me, that there would be many, many demonstrations and meetings and challenges, legal and on the street, to oppose that kind of wish list. But it just shows what their plan is for us and how we have to develop an alternative that's based on securing people's rights and living in a society that is a communal society and not one where everybody feels like they're in line and they better beat the other person because there's only going to be so much food or housing or jobs to go around. No, that can't be our vision. Our vision must be one of solidarity, not just for our own family, but for the larger community and the larger environment in which we live.
Diane Feeley, we are sadly just about out of time, but tell us about the organization, one of them to which you belong, Solidarity, and about the publication Against the Current, which you help edit.
Thank you very much for mentioning that. So people can go to the website Against the Current and see our current and back issues and get a subscription if they'd like. They can go to the Solidarity-US website and look at the articles and ideas there. And we're actually running a series of classes on fascism, taking a look at history and today. And people can register for that. So thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us today, really, Diane Feeley. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. It's been terrific talking to you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Last fall, the internationally acclaimed Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City filed a lawsuit in federal court on behalf of several Palestinian groups and individuals against President Joe Biden, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, alleging that Israel's actions in Gaza have amounted to genocide and that Biden, Austin, and Blinken have failed their obligation under international law to prevent Israel from committing genocide in Gaza. The lawsuit claimed that the 1948 International Convention Against Genocide requires the U.S. and other countries to use their power and influence to stop the killing. And the lawsuit asked the court to bar the U.S. from providing weapons, money, and support to Israel. At the time of the filing of that lawsuit here on Law and Disorder, we spoke with an attorney from CCR about the case. Well, since that time, there have been a number of developments in the case. So today we've invited attorney Maria LaHood, the deputy legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, or CCR, to join us to bring us up to date on where the lawsuit now stands. Much of Maria LaHood's own work at CCR is on behalf of defending the constitutional rights of Palestinian advocates in the United States, such as in the case of Davis v. Cox, a case on behalf of defending Olympia Food Co-op board members for deciding to boycott Israeli goods, and the case of Awad v. Fordham, compelling the university to recognize Students for Justice in Palestine as a student club. So, Attorney Maria LaHood, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me, Jim and Michael.
Sure. Maria, please tell us something about the individuals and the organizations that the CCR is representing in the lawsuit against Biden, Blinken, and Austin.
Well, CCR represents two Palestinian organizations, Al-Haq, which has been advocating for Palestinian rights since 1979, and Defense for Children International Palestine, which has defended the rights of children in the occupied Palestinian territory since 1991. We also represent Palestinians in Gaza, Ahmed Abu Artema, who organized the Great March of Return, and he was at his father's house when Israel struck it, killing his 12-year-old son, Mohammed, his 10-year-old niece, and four other relatives, and he and other family members were severely injured. Dr. Omar al-Najjar is a young doctor who was displaced several times and was living and working in hospitals day and night. And Mohammed Abu Rokhba is a field researcher for Defense for Children International Palestine, who was also displaced numerous times. We also represent five Palestinian Americans who live in the U.S. and who still have family in Gaza. And hundreds of their relatives have been killed there. And their homes and their neighborhoods have been leveled, all with our tax dollars.
Maria, the testimony was powerful and stirring. Can you please talk to us about what they testified to?
Yes, it was very powerful. We had a four-hour hearing that was recorded, and it's actually online, so I'd encourage people to watch it on either CCR's website or the court's website. Dr. Omar al-Najjar testified via Zoom from a hospital in Rafah City about the catastrophic health situation there, the rampant infectious diseases, severe dehydration, and the lack of medication for even chronic illnesses. During the hearing, Israel struck the tents of displaced Palestinians nearby, so he had to run down to help care for the wounded. He also testified about how he had lost everything, his home, his neighborhood, his mosque, his university, his dreams. Khaled Khuzmar, who is the director of Defense for Children International Palestine, he also testified via Zoom, and he testified about the devastating impact of the genocide on children. One 12-year-old girl he talked about, Dunya Abu Mohsen, was in the hospital after she lost her leg in an Israeli airstrike that killed her parents and two of her siblings. And there's actually a video of her in Nasser Hospital talking about how she wanted someone to take her abroad to get a prosthetic so she could walk again, and how she wanted to be a doctor when she grew up so she could treat children. And then a few weeks after that video, Israel shelled Nasser Hospital and killed her. Then we also had testimony from our clients in the U.S., and that was live testimony, and they testified about their relatives who had been killed in just really excruciating, powerful, emotional detail. Again, hundreds of people we're talking about with U.S. tax dollars, and how dehumanizing that is to have your own government be killing your relatives, and really stigmatizing all Palestinians and Palestinian Americans here. And of course, these are just a few stories of 2 million people whose lives have been devastated, who've been displaced, who are suffering from mass starvation. 42,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israel, 100,000 injured, and now, of course, it's expanding. We also had testimony from Dr. Barry Trachtenberg, who is an expert on genocide and Holocaust studies and Jewish studies, and he gave powerful testimony about how we're in a unique situation here, watching Israel's genocide unfold, where we can actually do something to stop it. And I should say, this was in January, this testimony, you know, and now we're here in October. And he also testified to how this is why people study genocide and why people study the Holocaust, because of the promise of never again. And here we are, a year later, and we haven't managed to stop it.
Dear me, and by the way, The Lancet, the leading medical journal in Great Britain, believes the death figure in Gaza is already over 150,000. But the trial judge did agree with you about the plausibility of genocide being committed and also about the complicity of the defendants, that is to say, the Biden administration, in that probable or possible genocide. But he nevertheless dismissed the case on jurisdictional grounds. So why did he rule as he did on jurisdiction? What was his argument? What arguments did you use to contend that the court did indeed have jurisdiction? And while you're at it, is it not the case that you received, well, a great deal of support by way of amicus briefs, you know, friend of the court briefs? What did they argue?
Right. So, yes, the court did find a case of plausible genocide and implored the U.S. officials to stop their unflagging support for it. But, you know, defendants had made several arguments and the court was interested in the political question doctrine, which is a constitutional separation of powers issue. Political questions are for the political branches and legal questions are for the judiciary. You know, the U.S. government ratified the Genocide Convention, promising the international community it would take measures to prevent genocide. And it implemented the convention by making genocide and complicity in genocide a federal crime. So, you know, we're asking the court to adjudicate the legal question of whether top U.S. officials are complicit, not the wisdom of providing military aid to Israel. But Judge White disagreed, unfortunately. And he decided that plaintiffs were challenging the appropriateness of providing aid, which he found impedes the administration's foreign affairs powers. But the Constitution doesn't grant the executive foreign affairs powers writ large, and it clearly grants the judiciary the power, in fact, the duty, to determine the law. And yeah, we received really powerful amicus support. Amicus briefs are friend of the court briefs from individuals or groups that aren't parties to the case but are interested in the issue or the outcome. We had human rights organizations and lawyers from around the world explain that the prohibition of genocide is a peremptory norm, so that no state may violate, and that domestic courts are supposed to be the primary enforcement mechanism of international law and are really the only meaningful fora for the United States government because it doesn't acknowledge or participate in other fora. We also had domestic civil rights organizations that documented the devastating harm on the estimated 220,000 Palestinian Americans in the U.S., and in particular the harm caused by U.S. complicity in the genocide. Jewish Voice for Peace argued that courts must review the complicity of the U.S. in Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza, which not only erases the memory of Jewish people and others slaughtered in the Holocaust, but also makes a mockery of the Genocide Convention. And then we had other powerful amicus briefs submitted throughout the case, and they're all available on CCR's website.
Tell us what the website is while we're talking about it.
The site is ccrjustice.org. And you can search for the case, you know, either genocide or Biden, and pull up the case page. And there we have not only the amicus briefs, but all of the pleadings and the testimony are available too.
Thanks, Maria. Maria, after losing at the trial court level, you appealed to the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals and argued the case before a panel of three judges. That argument was the past June 14th. What were your arguments on behalf of that appeal, and what was the result of that appeal?
So we argued that in dismissing the case on political question grounds, the district court erred because courts, including the Supreme Court, have repeatedly held that it's the judiciary's constitutional role to adjudicate legal disputes, and there's no policy discretion to aid and abet genocide. You know, the court's dismissal conflicts with Supreme Court precedent since Marbury versus Madison that has repeatedly affirmed that the coequal judiciary must fulfill its constitutional mandate to decide cases and controversies, even in when the legality of the executive conduct is being questioned, and it's not a discretionary policy decision that's at issue. So, you know, even when the U.S. itself has been at war, the Supreme Court has made clear that the president doesn't have a blank check to do whatever he wants. And, you know, we also argued that even if the court did have concerns about enjoining U.S. military support to Israel, it could undoubtedly issue a declaratory judgment saying that Israel's committing genocide and that the U.S. is complicit. And then it would be up to, you know, the U.S. officials to change their conduct accordingly. Unfortunately, the appeals panel disagreed and affirmed the dismissal, finding that the political question doctrine precludes courts from adjudicating claims rooted in international law that strongly implicate U.S. foreign policy.
On August 29th then of this year, you filed an appeal from that decision of those three judges, asking that your case be given a hearing before a full bench of appellate court judges in the Ninth Circuit. And in that appeal, you also moved to disqualify all three of the judges on the panel of the lower court who had heard your case. What are the main arguments you made on behalf of this latest appeal?
Yes, we filed a petition for a rehearing en banc, which are rarely granted, but they're supposed to be granted where there's a question of exceptional importance. And I cannot imagine a more important factual case trying to stop complicity of our government in an ongoing and escalating genocide, or a more important legal issue, which is whether courts are powerless to review any legal questions implicating foreign policy, which would have widespread ramifications. We also argued, which is another reason to get en banc review, that the panel's decision conflicts with the precedent of the Supreme Court, the Ninth Circuit, and other circuits, which, as I mentioned, has made clear that the political question doctrine doesn't preclude adjudication of cases just because they implicate foreign policy.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my longtime friend, colleague, and past law partner, Jim Lafferty, who's the co-host of Law and Disorder. We're speaking with one of the leaders of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Maria LaHood. Maria, how were your arguments received by the judges? For example, I understand that you succeeded in getting at least one of them, one of the three judges who had taken a trip to Israel, you got him removed from the case. Isn't that correct? And has there yet been a final ruling on this case by the full bench of judges? And if so, what was the ruling?
You know, we filed our petition for rehearing en banc, and we have not gotten a decision by the court yet. They can ask the defendants to respond if they're interested. As I mentioned before, it's very rare to get an en banc petition granted, but obviously it does happen, and we believe it should happen here. And yes, we moved for the panel. We moved to disqualify Judge Ryan Nelson, who had originally been assigned to the panel, and we filed a motion to disqualify him because he had gone on a World Jewish Congress delegation to Israel that was explicitly designed to influence U.S. judges' opinions on the legality of Israeli military action against Palestinians. And we argued that there, at the very least, was an appearance of bias because of that. And he recused himself from the case. So we had a new panel judge replace him. So for the en banc petition, you know, which is, it's heard by the full court, and in the Ninth Circuit, the active judges are, there are 29 active judges. So, you know, there were several other judges on that same delegation to Israel. So, and two of them were in the Ninth Circuit. So we, with the en banc petition, we also moved to disqualify judges Patrick Bumate and Lawrence Van Dyke from even deliberating on the case because they participated in the same delegation to Israel. And, you know, we need a majority of the active judges to vote to grant the petition for rehearing. So, and there's no reason that they shouldn't recuse because Judge Nelson recused for the very same reason. So we haven't received a decision on that motion either, but you know, for the petition, we really hope the judges are courageous enough to do the right thing.
Well, Maria, let's talk a little bit about the international justice system, because After all, the International Court of Justice found that Israel was possibly committing genocide and recommended measures to curb the country's military. That judgment, nevertheless, is being ignored. It's being ignored by Israel. It's being ignored by the United States. So I guess my question is this an indication to you that the international legal system established after World War II is coming unraveled, or at least has very few teeth?
Yeah, I should mention that the International Court of Justice's provisional measures came down on January 26th, the morning before our hearing before the court. And the court was extremely interested in that opinion. And, he even reflected that plausibility language in his own opinion. And he had several questions that day about, well, where else can the plaintiffs go? Isn't there an international mechanism? Can't they join a case at the ICJ? Which they can't. But he was troubled, I believe, by the fact that the U.S. court was the only avenue, and that avenue was being blocked by the government and eventually, ultimately by him. I think the international legal system is constantly being tested, I guess, just like any other legal system. One perspective is the progress that has been made shows that the legal system is working. The fact that the ICC prosecutor actually requested arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, which only happened after years of Palestinian organizations demanding accountability, is actually progress. And the fact that the ICJ ordered Israel to stop its genocidal acts in the case that South Africa brought, and in the more recent advisory opinion it issued declaring that Israel's very presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is illegal. And that is all progress. But, on the other hand, Israel's genocide has continued unabated while it increases its atrocities in the West Bank and is bombing and terrorizing Lebanon. And that shows that it's not enough. And the fact that the pretrial chamber still hasn't issued arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant. And we are, it couldn't be more urgent for them to do so. So laws need to be enforced. And, the United States still doesn't have the political will to do that. So it's really up to all of us to force our government to do it. We're in the middle of this struggle, not only for the people of Palestine and the people of Lebanon, but also for the rule of law and ultimately for our own humanity.
Maria, Michael Ratner, the past president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, had a sign over his desk talking about what principles we should follow. And one of them was, don't take a lawsuit just because you think you're going to win. Take it because it's the right thing to do and because it helps educate and mobilize people. And could you talk about this lawsuit in that context?
Yes, there hasn't been a day I haven't missed Michael, and especially in this last horrible year. And we think of him all the time and how he was always pushing us to be bolder. We think we should win this lawsuit. It's correct on the law, but there are other reasons to litigate, and there are things that it has brought about. We have had, first of all, just the hearing alone that we were able to have on the preliminary injunction motion, to have the opportunity for our clients, Palestinians, to testify in a federal court, and to have that court really seemingly moved by their testimony and making a historical record of the ongoing Nakba is extremely powerful. This has also been an opportunity. We talked about some of the amicus briefs we've gotten. I wish there were, it's also provided media opportunities and pressure points, although I wish there was more discussion of the lawsuit in the mainstream media and of U.S. complicity. But I think in so many ways, the mainstream media has been complicit with this genocide and still is. So, yes. And I think, not only is the litigation important for all these reasons, really, we want to support the movement and the growing movement, which is so critical, that people continue to demand our government stop this genocide, to protest, to engage in boycott, divestment, and sanctions, you know, really to scream at the top of their lungs until this genocide stops. So I appreciate you bringing Michael into the room. Thanks, Michael.
How can people follow your work, the work of the CCR? Can you please talk about that so they can get involved?
Yes, please do follow our work. You can check out our website at ccrjustice.org. You can sign up for our mailing list. You can also follow us on all the social media channels, you know, on Instagram and X. And yeah, please do follow our work and make some change.
Thank you for your good work on this. It's really been quite extraordinary. And thank you for this excellent interview. And you take it easy.
Thanks so much, Michael. Thanks, Jim.
A quick reminder, if you want to listen to Law & Disorder's podcast, one way to do that is visit lawanddisorder.org. There you'll see our podcast players now positioned at the bottom of each show's post. And there you can click on the three dots in the right corner of the player to either, well, download, subscribe, or visit the podcast page. Good. That's great.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811, brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
Email from school. How about the incident today?
Scary.
Tell me about it. Did you have any idea that was going on?
None. I mean, you saw Derek at the game last night, too. Did you have a clue?
No. But you know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do. Kids hear first about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
It can be hard to tell sometimes. But if you have a concern about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, bullying, violence, anything, you need to tell an adult. Mom or me, a teacher, coach, school counselor, someone you know and trust.
Dad, no kid is gonna tell an adult about that kind of stuff.
I get it, but if we don't know, we can't help. Speaking up about a problem, that's what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Again, I knew I wanted to be in commercial real estate, but I didn't know anybody. So my sister happened to be dating a politician who was an important guy in town, Michael Hightower. So I called Michael. It made sense to me. Let me call the most influential person I knew to see if he knew anybody. And he did. He introduced me to a guy named Bill Comer. And I asked Bill, is it possible for me to come and shadow you because I'm thinking about getting into commercial real estate? He said, I'll work it out. It may not be with me, but it'll be somebody in my shop. It ended up being a guy named Steve Gaultney. Steve was kind enough to allow me to shadow him, and he took me around, showed me some listings and some properties that he sold before and clients that he was working with. He said, I'm going to take you to a meeting. Don't say anything, but you can sit in on a meeting and listen.
T. Dallas Smith, founder and CEO of T. Dallas Smith & Company, the largest African-American-owned pure tenant representation commercial real estate firm in the country. For more than a decade and a half, TDS & Company has taken pride in catering to the needs of clients requiring office space, industrial facilities, and land. Headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, with affiliate offices in Boston, Dallas, Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego, and Short Hills, New Jersey, their projects span the nation. In 1989, Smith became the first African-American broker at Cushman & Wakefield of Georgia. 6 years later, he would go on to pioneer the broker division of Atlanta's landmark African-American-owned real estate and construction firm, H.J. Russell & Company. Throughout his career, Smith had dedicated himself to exposing African-Americans to the commercial real estate industry. In case you weren't aware, less than 4% of commercial real estate executives are African-American. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, T. Dallas Smith & Company with founder and CEO T. Dallas Smith, In Black America.
December 2006, I was partners with another guy, had another company I was partners with, but that company was kind of going under. But during that process, I met a young man who happened to be 19, came to me and wanted to get into real estate. And a lot of people would do that. Nobody years, I would say, do you have your license? And people typically say, no, I don't. I say, get your license. We'll talk. Now, I've done it other years to at least 50 people, and nobody ever came back. But this kid, Leonte Benton, came back in 3 weeks with his license, which is unheard of. And at this point, I'm going, okay, the company I'm a part of is kind of about to go under. I get the epiphany that this kid is a lot like me, and that what I really need to do is start a brokerage company, and I can help this guy and help other people who look like me get into the space.
Under T. Dallas Smith's leadership, his commercial real estate firm, T. Dallas Smith & Company, will go on to work with some of the largest companies in the nation, from Microsoft and Coca-Cola to AT&T and FedEx. Born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, Smith grew up in an all-black neighborhood in Hunter Hills. But when his family moved to College Park, it was an eye-opener. He quickly learned that the color of his skin would dramatically affect his experience in the world. Smith knew early on he wanted to make a lot of money, and commercial real estate would make that happen. In 2006, Smith was at the height of his commercial real estate career. He had been mentored early on by Thomas W. Taft and would later pioneer the broker division of H.J. Russell & Company, where he served as the division vice president. Today, T. Dallas Smith & Company is the largest African-American-owned pure tenant representation commercial real estate firm in the nation. Recently in Black America, spoke with T. Dallas Smith.
Yeah, I tell people I'm Atlanta born, Atlanta bred. When I die, I'll be Atlanta dead. I love this city. And that statement came from somebody named Raphael De Hill, who actually used to be a radio guy. Mm-hmm. But it's a true statement. And grateful. When I grew up in the West Side in Hunter Hill. It was paradise. Everybody took care of one another. I didn't have to worry about anybody breaking your house or anything like that. It was just a wonderful place. And but unfortunately, we moved in 76 when a lot of other folks who looked like us moved out of our communities and moved out into the suburbs. Mm-hmm. You know, as a 62-year-old man, I was 14 when that happened. But now at 62, I know we messed up. You know, it was. We thought we were going somewhere better, but you know, literally the day we moved there was the first day I was called the N-word. We were the first family on our street in College Park, and so I got thrown into this race thing really quick because I grew up in an all-black family, all-black community. I never dealt with anything racial until we moved to College Park, and I got a crash course real fast about, you know, some folks don't want to see you coming to their community. So I dealt with that at 14, and I tell this story, and the sad thing about it was I really wasn't that upset with the kids who threw rocks at me and called me names. I was more upset with my parents for moving us out of Hunter Hill. And it's full circle for me now. I bought a house in Hunter Hill a couple of years ago, and the plan is to move back to where I all started.
Yeah, I understand. What sparked that interest in real estate?
You know, it's funny. I didn't really know what I wanted to be when I grew up. The only consistent thing was I knew I wanted to make a lot of money. That was the one consistent thing. So I took a Forbes magazine in 1982 and studied what the richest people in the world did. That was, ironically, the first year they came out with their list of 400 richest people. And I just took this is before computers, and, so I did an old-fashioned index card. I'd write down Warren Buffett, investor, Omaha, Nebraska, and what his net worth. And I did with T. Boone Pickens, oil man, Texas, his net worth. So I did this with all 400 people, and I came out with one conclusion, that the richest people in the world, they do four things, one of four things. And they got to remember, this is 1982. They're in investment business, Wall Street, oil business, that was in Texas. Technology was kind of just coming up. And then this thing called real estate. As I mentioned, I'm from Atlanta. I wanted to stay in Atlanta. So Wall Street would have taken me to New York. Oil would have taken me to Texas. Technology just wasn't my personality. So it left me with real estate. And I was a young man, 19 years old. I had a new car. My dad said if I did well, he'd buy me a new car. I had a Fiat X19, two-seater, emphasis on the two-seater. So I didn't want to take nobody around on the weekends in the car. So that knocked out residential. So I literally just backed into commercial real estate. And so that was really what got it started.
And that first job was Atlanta Air Center Realty?
Atlanta Air Center Realty. I worked with a guy by the name of Thomas W. Tift. Tift County, Tift College. I mean, it was that family. So this was 1982. I happened to, I knew I wanted to be in commercial real estate, but I didn't know anybody. So my sister happened to be dating a politician who was an important guy in town, Michael Hightower. So I called Michael. It made sense to me. Let me call the most influential person I knew to see if he knew anybody. And he did. He introduced me to a guy named Bill Comer. And I asked Bill, is it possible for me to come and shadow you because I'm thinking about getting into commercial real estate? He said, I'll work it out. It may not be with me, but it'll be somebody in my shop. It ended up being a guy named Steve Gaultney. Steve was kind enough to allow me to shadow him, and he took me around, showed me some listings and some properties that he sold before and clients that he was working with. He said, I'm going to take you to a meeting. Don't say anything, but you can sit in on a meeting and listen. And so in the meeting, what I did not realize, he was representing the tenant. The guy he was talking to was representing the building. And they were kind of going back and forth. Before we left, they shook hands. We left. He said, you have any questions? I said, yeah, well, it looked like it kind of started off a little slow, but it looked like you came to an agreement. He said, yes, we did. I said, I just got one question. I said, how much money are you going to make? He laughed. He said, I'll make $30,000 off that transaction. This is in 1982. When the median income for a family of four was $28,000. And I just saw this guy do that, relatively easy. So I was like, yeah, this is for me. And so I didn't look back. But he was kind enough to take me to lunch. And while I was at lunch, I met a guy named Tom Thompson. Tom told me about Mr. Tiff. And they say the rest is history. But I worked with Mr. Tiff for 6 years. He taught me the game. So I was on the landlord side for the first 6 years in the industry. And went through my first recession, mm-hmm. and didn't ever want to be stuck with just buildings. I wanted to be able to represent tenants and take them anywhere, regardless of what the market might do. And that's what got me into tenant rep. And I had not looked back. That was almost 43 years ago.
After those 6 years, did you go out on your own or you went to another company?
So, yeah, after the first 6 years with Mr. Tiff, I ended up going to work for Cushman & Wakefield in 1989. And Cushman, I was the first black broker that Cushman hired in Georgia. They were owned by the Rockefellers, which was interesting. The MO was, if you didn't come from money, you didn't work with Cushman & Wakefield. Cushman was known as the Blue Bloods. Now, and I didn't come from the Blue Bloods. My dad drove a taxi and worked at Lockheed. My mama kept kids at the house. So it was God's grace and his determination to place my feet where I needed to be. And so I ended up being at Cushman, learned a lot. Learned a whole lot. One of the things how me and 40 other brokers, and I say it that way because I was never really in the pack. So that was really what I would describe as the island moment. But thank God for Mr. Tiff. I knew how to work hard, and nobody was going to outwork me. So grateful for that. And but yeah, it was Cushman & Wakefield. I was there for 6 years.
How did H.J. Russell and Company play in what you're doing now?
So Herman Russell, when I came to Cushman, the very first cold call I ever made was to Herman Russell. And left a voicemail message. Well, not a voicemail message. I spoke with his assistant. His assistant was named Barbara. Basically told Barbara I was the first black broker at Cushman & Wakefield. Wanted to meet with Mr. Russell, you know, who was somebody who I idolized my whole